Chapter 78. Sly Reynolds, as they call the fox, would take the spicy dustman turned his animal down the lane from Squashtail to Cutchin's Common, across which, sure enough, came the whole hunt. There's a small edge and a remarkably fine ditch here. Some of the leading chaps took both, in gallant style, others went round by a gate, and so would I, only I couldn't. For Trumpeter would have the edge, and be hanged to him, and went right for it. Hoop, if ever you did try a leap, out go your legs, out fling your arms, off goes your hat, and the next thing you feel that is, I did is a most tremendous thwack across the chest, and my feet jerked out of the stirrups. Me left in the branches of a tree, Trumpeter gone clean from under me, and walloping and floundering in the ditch underneath. One of the stirrup leathers had caught in a stake, and the horse couldn't get away. And neither of us, I thought, ever would have got away. But all of a sudden, who should come up the lane, but the spicy dustman. Holloa, says I, you gent, just let us down from this here tree. Lor, says he, I'm blessed if I didn't take you for a robin. Let's down, says I. But he was all the time employed in disengaging Trumpeter, whom he got out of the ditch, trembling and as quiet as possible. "It's down," says one. "Presently," says he, and taking off his coat, he begins whistling and swishing down Trumpeter's sides and saddle, and when he had finished, what do you think the rascal did? He just quietly mounted on Trumpeter's back, and shouts out, "Get down yourself, old beerscris. You've only to drop. I'll give your us a herring arter the mounds, and if I, you may ride back my pony to Tuggeridge Wheel." And with this, I'm blessed if he didn't ride away, leaving me holding, as for the dear life, and expecting every minute the branch would break. It did break too, and down I came into the slush, and when I got out of it, I can tell you I didn't look much like the Venuses or the Apollo Bolvidorus, what I used to dress, and titivate up for my shop window, when I was in the hairdressing line, or smell quite so elegant as a rose oil. Faugh! What a figure I was! I had nothing for it, but to mount the dustman's donkey which was very quietly cropping grass in the hedge, and to make my way home, and after a weary journey, I arrived at my own gate. A whole party was assembled there. Tagrag, who had come back, their excellencies Mace and Punter, who were on a visit, and a number of horses walking up and down before the whole of the gentlemen of the hunt, who had come in, after losing their fox. "Here's Squire Cox," shouted the grooms. Out rushed the servants, out poured the gents of the hunt, and on trotted poor me, digging into the donkey, and everybody dying with laughter at me. Just as I got up to the door, a horse came galloping up, and past me, a man jumped down, and taking off a fantail hat, came up, very gravely, to help me down. "Squire," says he, "how came you by that there animal? Just get down, will you, and give it to its owner?" "Rascal," says I, "didn't you ride off on my horse? Was there ever such ingratitude?" Says the spicy. "Found this here ass in a pond, I saves him from drowning, I brings him back to his master, and he calls me a rascal." The grooms, the gents, the ladies in the balcony, my own servants, all set up a roar at this, and so would I, only I was so deucedly ashamed, as not to be able to laugh just then. And so my first day's hunting ended. Tagrag and the rest declared I showed great pluck, and wanted me to try again. But oh, says I have been. The finishing touch. I was always fond of billiards. And, in former days, at Grogram's in Greek Street, where a few jolly lads of my acquaintance used to meet twice a week for a game, and a snug pipe and beer, I was generally voted the first man of the club, and could take five from John the Marker himself. I had a genius, in fact, for the game. And now that I was placed in that station of life, where I could cultivate my talents, I gave them full play, and improved amazingly. I do say, that I think myself as good a hand as any chap in England. The Count and His Excellency Baron von Punter were, I can tell you, astonished by the smartness of my play. The first two or three rubbers Punter beat me, but when I came to know his game, I used to knock him all to sticks, or, at least, win 6-4. And such was the betting upon me, His Excellency losing large sums to the Count, who knew what play was, and used to back me. I did not play except for shillings, so my skill was of no great service to me. One day I entered the billiard room, where these three gentlemen were high in words. He thing shall not be done, I heard Captain Tagrac say colon I won't stand it. That, because you would have the bird all to yourself, hey? Said the Baron. You shall not have a single feather of him, beaker, said the Count. We will blow you, M. de Tagwarag. Per old honor, we will. What's all this, gents, says I, stepping in, about birds and feathers. Oh, says Tagrag, we were talking about pigeon shooting. The Count here says he will blow a bird all to pieces at 20 yards, and I said I wouldn't stand it, because it was regular murder. Oh, yes, it was pigeon shooting, cries the Baron colon and I know no better sport. Have you been pigeon shooting, my dear squire? The fondest capital. No doubt, says I, for the shooters, but mighty bad sport for the pigeon. And this joke set them all a laughing ready to die. I didn't know then what a good joke it was, neither, but I gave Master Baron, that day, a precious good beating, and walked off with no less than 15 shillings of his money. As a sporting man, and a man of fashion, I need not say that I took in the flare-up regularly, eh, and wrote one or two trifles in that celebrated publication, one of my papers, which Tagrac subscribed for me, Philo Pestiti Amicus, on the proper sauce for teal and Wigian and the other, signed Scrutatos, on the best means of cultivating the kidney species of that vegetable made no small noise at the time, and got me in the paper a compliment from the editor. I was a constant reader of the notices to correspondence, and, my early education having been rather neglected, for I was taken from my studies and set, as is the custom in our trade, to practice on a sheep's head at the tender age of 9 years, before I was allowed to venture on the humane countenance. I say, being thus curtailed, and cut off in my classical learning, I must confess I managed to pick up a pretty smattering of genteel information from that treasury of all sorts of knowledge, at least sufficient to make me a match in learning for all the noblemen and gentlemen who came to our house. Well, on looking over the flare-up notices to correspondence, I read, one day last April, among the notices, as follows. Automoden. ... We do not know the precise age of Mr. Baker of Covent Garden Theatre, nor are we aware if that celebrated son of Thespis is a married man. Ducks and Green Peas is informed that when A plays his rook to B second knight's square, and B, moving 2 squares with his queen's pawn, gives check to his adversary's queen, there is no reason why B's queen should not take A's pawn, if B be so inclined. F50. ... We have repeatedly answered the question about Madame Vestris. Her maiden name was Bartolozzi, and she married the son of Charles Matthews, the celebrated comedian. Fair play. ... The best amateur billiard and ecarte player in England is Cox Tuggeridge Cox Esquire, of Portland Place and Tuggeridgeville. Jonathan, who knows his play, can only give him 2 in a game of 100, and, at the cards, no man is his superior. Verbum sap. Scipio Americanus is a blockhead. I read this out to the Count and Tagrag, and both of them wondered how the editor of that tremendous flare-up should get such information, and both agreed that the Baron, who still piqued himself absurdly on his play, would be vastly annoyed by seeing me preferred thus to himself. We read him the paragraph, and preciously angry he was. Diaz, he cried, the tables or e-dabbles, as he called them, e-or-dabbles. Come with me to London, and dry a slate table, and I will beat you. We all roared at this, and the end of the dispute was that, just to satisfy the fellow, I agreed to play His Excellency at slate tables, or any tables he chose. Gut, says he, gut, I live, you know, at Abednego's, in the quadrant. His dabbles is good. We will play dear, if you will. And I said I would. And it was agreed that, one Saturday night, when Jemmy was at the opera, we should go to the Baron's rooms, and give him a chance. We went, and the little Baron had as fine a supper as ever I saw. Lots of champagne, and I didn't mind drinking it, and plenty of laughing and fun. Afterwards, down we went to billiards. Es dich Mr. Cox, the celebrated player? Says Mr. Abednego, who was in the room, with one or two gentlemen of his own persuasion, and several foreign noblemen, dirty, snuffy, and hairy, as them foreigners are. Es dich Mr. Cox? Bless my heart, it is an honor to see you. I have heard so much of your play. Come, come, says I, sir, for I'm pretty wide awake, one of your gammon. You're not going to book me. No, beaker, this fish you not catch, says Count Mace. That is gut. Ha, ha, snorted the Baron. Hook him. Lieber Himmel, you might try and hook me as well. Ha, ha. Well, we went to play. I've 2-4 on Cox, screams out the Count. One and done, says another nobleman. Honnes, says the Count. One, says the nobleman. We'll take your 6 crowns 2-4, says the Baron. One, says one. And, in the twinkling of an eye, I beat him once making 13 off the balls without stopping. We had some more wine after this. And if you could have seen the long faces of the other noblemen, as they pulled out their pencils and wrote IOUs for the Count. Eight-ougers, monsieur, says he to me, you have on for me £300. I'll play you guineas this time, says the Baron. Even 2-4 you must give me though. And so I did. And in 10 minutes, that game was won, and the Baron handed over his pounds. 160 more, my dear, dear Cox, says the Count, colon, you are mon ange guardian. Ade flat Mr. Cox shiz, not to back his luck, I heard Abednego whisper to one of the foreign noblemen. I'll take your 7-4, in tens, said I to the Baron. Give me 3, says he, and done. I gave him 3, and lost the game by 1. Abel, or quits, says he. Oh it, says I, up to my medal colon Sam Cox never says no, and to it we went. I went in, and scored 18-5. Holy moshish, says Abednego, that little Cox is a wonder. Who'll take odds? I'll give 20-1, says I, in guineas. Pones, yes, done, screams out the Count. Bonies, done, roars out the Baron. And, before I could speak, went in, and would you believe it? In 2 minutes he somehow made the game. Oh, what a figure I cut when my dear Jemmy heard of this afterwards. In vain I swore it was guineas. The Count and the Baron swore 2 ponies, and when I refused, they both said their honor was concerned, and they must have my life, or their money. So when the Count showed me actually that, in spite of this bet which had been too good to resist, won from me, he had been a very heavy loser by the night, and brought me the word of honor of Abednego, his Jewish friend, and the foreign nobleman, that ponies had been betted, why, I paid them £1,000 sterling of good and lawful money. But I've not played for money since. No, no, catch me at that again if you can. A new drop scene at the opera. No lady is a lady without having a box at the opera. So my Jemmy, who knew as much about music, bless her, as I do about Sanskrit, algebra, or any other foreign language, took a prime box on the second tier. It was what they called a double box. It really could hold 2, that is, very comfortably, and we got it a great bargain for £500 a year. Here, Tuesdays and Saturdays, we used regularly to take our places, Jemmy and Jemimran sitting in front, me, behind. but as my dear wife used to wear a large fantail gauze hat with ostrich feathers, birds of paradise, artificial flowers, and tags of muslin or satin, scattered all over it, I'm blessed if she didn't fill the whole of the front of the box. And it was only by jumping and dodging, 3 or 4 times in the course of the night, that I could manage to get a sight of the actors. By kneeling down, and looking steady under my darling Jemmy's sleeve, I did contrive, every now and then, to have a peep of Senior Lablash's boots, in the Eritney, and once actually saw Madame Greasy's crown and headdress in the balcony. What a place that opera is, to be sure! And what enjoyments us aristocracy used to have! Just as you have swallowed down your 3 courses, 3 curses I used to call them, for so, indeed, they are, causing a deal of heartburns, headaches, doctor's bills, pills, want of sleep, and such like. Just, I say, as you get down your 3 courses, which I defy any man to enjoy properly, unless he has 2 hours of drink and quiet afterwards, up comes the carriage, in bursts my Jemmy, as fine as a duchess, and scented like our shop. Oh, my dear, says she, it's Normie tonight, or the Balony, or the OCDI Figaro, or the Azalerter, as the case may be. Mr. Foster strikes off punctually at 8, and you know it's the fashion, to be always present at the very first bar of the aperture. And so off we are obliged to budge, to be miserable for 5 hours, and to have a headache for the next 12, and all because it's the fashion. After the aperture, as they call it, comes the opera, which, as I am given to understand, is the Italian for singing. Why they should sing in Italian, I can't conceive, or why they should do nothing but sing. Bless us! How I used to long for the wooden magpie in the Azalerter, to fly up to the top of the church steeple, with the silver spoons, and see the chaps with the pitchforks, come in and carry off that wicked Don June. Not that I don't admire Lablash, and Rubini, and his brother, Tom Rubini. Him who has that fine bass voice, I mean, and acts the corporal in the first piece, and Don June in the second. But 3 hours is a little too much, for you can't sleep on those little rickety seats in the boxes. The opera is bad enough, but what is that to the belly? You should have seen my Jemmy the first night, when she stopped to see it. And when Madame Sol's Fanny and Teresa Hussler came forward, along with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.